Good morning and welcome to the 2014 OA Birthday Party Workshop. My name is Andrea, and I am your moderator for this workshop.
Hi, Andrea.
Please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. During this two-hour workshop, we will have OA members who will share their experience, strength, and hope on the topic of recovery from relapse. There will be a question and answer portion following our speakers. Volunteers will be passing an Ask It basket to collect the questions you may have for our panel. And on your table, you will see there's pens and small pieces of paper, or if you need a big piece of paper, that's fine, to write your question. Please try to write it with the intention of somebody else reading it. I've been moderating these, and that has been a challenge at times. Also, there will be time provided after the question and answer for workshop participants to write on this topic. We have a 10-minute writing time, followed by 3-minute pitches when you may choose to share your writing or to speak with whatever you would like to experience in recovering from relapse. If members choose to share, please remember that the OA Birthday Party events are recorded, so if you do choose to share, there will be a piece of paper for you to sign a release form acknowledging that you know you're being recorded. Now, please join me in warmly welcoming our first speaker, Ziva.
Hi, good morning. My name is Ziva, and I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Ziva.
And I'm a little nervous, and I realize that nervousness for me is a good thing. It's a sign of a little humility, because there were years when I thought I had the answer before my relapse, and I wasn't nervous at all. I got up there, and I had the message, and I knew it, and I could tell you how to do it. So a little nervousness is good. I'm going to pass my picture that reflects my relapse, because I came into the program in a normal body weight, feeling obese, and I, within the program, gained and lost 75 pounds several times. So let me start by telling you a little about my past. I was born in Israel, as you can tell by my heavy New York accent. And I was born into a very dysfunctional, chaotic, and anxiety-provoking household. And at a very early age, as early as 2, I discovered that food can calm me down, regulate my anxiety, and give me the message that everything is going to be okay. So what was very useful and life-saving at age 2 became not working later, but that's the reason why I continue to eat throughout my life, in order to regulate my anxiety, to calm me down, and to give me this illusion of feeling while I put that food in my mouth, which was always comfort food. I was always yearning comfort food. I wasn't yearning escargot or any very sexy food. It was always comfort food. It was pudding. It was custard. It was pasta. It was... So I think that during my teen years, I crossed the line from using food to do all those things that really worked to abusing food. And my kind of eating, which I think is common to many of us, was characterized by self-hate and aggression. It wasn't kind eating. When I was binging, it was very, very hateful and aggressive. So we'll fast forward. I found OA in Israel in 1980, So it's 34 years ago. And I'm, by the way, 2 weeks ago, I celebrated 6 years of abstinence. So 28 years, I was, to him, in and out of relapse. So I found a way in Israel, and I enjoyed going to meetings because I met a bunch of people that spoke my language, really understood me, did what I did, and we became good friends. But there was very little talk about spirituality and about recovery. I don't think that we read the steps, but we chose to translate to Hebrew food for thought. That was the most important literature that we thought should be in Hebrew, not the big book. Now, by the way, they have the big book, they have everything. But anyway, so I joined the program in Israel, and then we moved to the United States, and I went to regular OA, trying to become abstinent and to grasp it, but I just could not get it. And then we moved to the East Coast, and I joined HOW. And I don't know if anybody here knows HOW, but HOW is a very rigid way of working the program that works for some people magic, and for those people, I am admiring their recovery. For me, that started a 10-year period of self-abuse. I was white-knuckling it. I was dieting like a crazy woman, and then I would not be able to tolerate anymore that restriction, and then I would binge. So in HOW, during those 10 years, I gained and lost 70 pounds 3 times, and you'll see in the picture. And then I left HOW. We moved back to California, and I came to OA. And, you know, during those years that I lived, you know, in Israel, in the East Coast, and back here, I'm one of those women that went to meetings. I would drive 3 hours to hear the best speaker. And then I would leave the conference, and on the way home, I would binge to celebrate their recovery. So I don't know what brings you to this room, whether you are just interested in hearing about relapse, whether you are coming out of relapse, whether you are in relapse, whether you are afraid of relapse, but that was my thing. I would go to those birthday parties. I would drive when I lived in Queens. I remember there was in Long Island some speaker that everybody was speaking about, and we drove a group of women. I think, I don't know how long, the whole day to hear her share for an hour. And then I came home and I binged. So I didn't get it. And I did my 4-step many times, but I just didn't get it. And what happened to change it all was not an act, it was a journey. But the first thing is that I realized that I need to seek some outside help to first realize where does this self-hate come from. And it says in the big book that if we need outside help, we get it. So I got it. The other thing that happened, because I always came to meetings, is that I realized that the people who have what I want in these rooms, and that changed over the years, because when I came in, I was in my 20s, and I wanted the people who had what I want were thin. But 30 years later, the people who had what I want were people who were having a healthy relationship with their body, with food, and with their family members. That's what I wanted. So, of course, they were in a healthy body weight, but that was the most important thing to me. And what I realized, that all those people who had what I want, who I met over the years, were from different ethnic groups, from different genders, from different countries, from different everything. They only had one thing in common. One. And the thing they had in common is that they were willing to be on a spiritual path. That's the only thing that those people who had what I want had. And I was not willing to be on a spiritual path. So that's a problem, because this is a spiritually based program. And, you know, my mother's entire family perished in the Holocaust. So I grew up with there is no God. If there was God, this wouldn't have happened. So it was a very challenging shift I needed to go through. And what helped me, I read a book by a rabbi called When Bad Things Happen to Good People. And this is a rabbi whose son got sick and died. And the whole horrific experience challenged his belief in God. But he said one sentence in the book that he, in order to reconnect with God, he had to believe that when his child got sick, God cried. And this shifted something in me because I suddenly said, and when the Holocaust happened, God cried. Because God gave us the power to choose, that's why we are different than animals, and the power to think. And when it's like when a child misuses that power, parents cry. Parents are very upset. So that was the beginning for me of the shift. And it opened my heart to the fact that there is something out there and I'm willing to start building a relationship with that something, whatever it is. So that brings me to 7 years ago that I, number one, became willing to search for a God. I was willing to follow directions. And I got a lot of insight through therapy into what made me hate myself so much. And I started healing that issue that is, it's an outside issue, so it doesn't matter right now. But I started a healing journey on all levels, emotionally, spiritually, and physically. And the way it looked in the last 6 years is that my abstinence, there is one piece of my abstinence that is black and white. I do not eat dessert of any kind, even if it's sugar-free, even if it's no calories, even if it's this, even if it's that. If it's a dessert, I don't eat it. That's black and white. And if I go out today and eat a cupcake, I broke my abstinence. And by the way, my sponsor keeps saying, if you choose to add those things into your plan, we can talk about it. But I know for today, there is no need to add anything. So that's black and white. But other than that, everything else in my life is now based on self-love, on kindness and on gentleness, and there is a lot of gray area. So that's on the physical level. On the spiritual level, God is very much part of my journey right now. And I can give you two examples from yesterday and from today. My son moved yesterday. He's 24. He moved for the first time, and he and his friend decided to move the stuff by themselves from the previous apartment. And I was very anxious that, you know, they're moving this really heavy furniture and those are kids that are working in high tech. They're not movers. And it's like, what is he thinking? And then I said, okay, I can tell him my suggestion and then I have to let go because it's not my responsibility and it's his journey and he would learn through it. As I tell parents, I work with parents, you need to give your children the dignity to make mistakes. So I wrote him a little note and I said, honey, good luck on your move. I'm busy until Sunday afternoon. If you need help unpacking, I'll be glad to help you. I really think that it will be a good idea to think about your back. You need your back for many, many more years. And I think before you carry a refrigerator on your back, maybe you should start with smaller weights. So he didn't respond, and I let go. I prayed. I turned it over. I really turned it over and didn't think about it. And then I got an email last night. The movers just finished. We hired movers. So it's like when I turn. Now, I could have done it differently. I could have said, what are you thinking? You know, it could have gone different way, and he would carry the refrigerator just to get at me. But I really turned it over. I said what I said, and I only said it once. So that's the deal with my kids, with friends, with people I supervise. I say what I say and I say it once. But I say what I mean and I don't say it mean. I say it kind and gentle. So that's, you know, one example. The other example, I heard great speakers yesterday throughout the entire day. And the chatter in my head this morning was, you don't meditate enough, you're not seen enough. You know, are you sure you can lead a workshop? Maybe you should be the... And then I just sat down quietly, set my timer for just 4 minutes. And I said, God, make me a channel of your love and I have something, a gift that I can give. I didn't eat dessert in six years. So even if that's the only thing I have to say, I have something that talks about recovery from relapse, because my relapse was binging on sugar all day long, and I haven't done it in 6 years. So, and then I sat still for the remaining 2 minutes, and then I got here. So God is in my life all the time. And there are other things I'm doing that are I need to do in order to support my abstinence, because as somebody yesterday said in one of the meetings, I cannot keep clean today on yesterday's shower. I had to shower this morning before I got here. And it's the same with the program. Every day I need to do the same things. Some of it is like a saving account in a bank, because, you know, when I got out of relapse, I remember day 10 was a very emotional day for some reason, and I said, that's it, fuck it. We don't care. I said, you know, I don't think I can do it. And I didn't have a bank account with 6 years of abstinence. It was only 10 days, and my head said, what makes you think you can do it? It's only 10 days. You've had 10 days many times in the past 28 years. So I needed to really pray hard and call people. But today, when I have that thought, I tell myself, you know, you've been doing it for 6 years, and if you do today what you did yesterday, you can continue. So I'll give you a few examples of things I do today that are just in order to fine-tune my mindfulness about eating, not about food, but about the activities around food. So, for example, in my neighborhood, there is a Wells Fargo, my bank, and then there is a Wells Fargo in the market. So I realize that when I go to Wells Fargo after work in the market, it's not working. So I don't go there anymore. And I go to the one that is standing by itself. And I go to the market only when I'm full and when I have a list. Because if I go to the market without a list, that's it. I end up buying things that I don't need. Okay. And when I, you know, so that's another thing. Now, I work in an agency that there are a lot of parties, and there are a lot of mile-long buffets. So my commitment, first of all, I bookend those events. And when I say bookend, I call my sponsor or someone or my partner before the event, and I say, I just want to send out there my intention. This is what I'm going to eat. I'm not walking to the buffet. It's not the dessert buffet. That's none of my business. But from the food, I'm going to have a plate of food and a plate of salad. And when I say it, and I said, and I'm calling you back at the end. So when I do it, number one, somebody else helps me hold that thing, and I become more accountable by making that commitment. So that's just another example. I also say a lot the set-aside prayer. Do you know that prayer? The set-aside prayer goes like that. God, I'll give you an example first, and then when I use it. So my partner went away, and I, because of my past, I really need connection. I have insecure attachment because of my past, and when a loved one goes away and I don't hear from them, I get very anxious. And she knows it. So she went away and we talked about it. I didn't hear from her for like 2.5 days. And I was like, she's hiking in Wyoming. She was killed already. I went to the land of no return. And then I realized that I wanted something to eat. And at that point, I went to the bathroom and I said, God, set aside everything I think I know about, and I said her name, for a new experience and an open mind of her name, and you, God. I think that's how it goes. And then I went back to my God, set aside everything I think I know, the way it goes originally, is about myself, about the 12 steps, and about you, God. For an open mind and a new experience of myself, the 12 steps, and you, God. And if you need, I'll tell you after the meeting again. So I said it, I went back to my desk, I started working, and 10 minutes later she calls. Hi, honey, I didn't have reception until now in the mountains. We just got reception now, and I knew that you are probably already anxious. But where I went in my head, you know, my head without this program is like a gang-infested neighborhood. And with this program, it's like a little coffee shop, you know, like quiet. Some people chat, maybe two people fight, sometimes that happens too. Somebody's angry, somebody's smiling, somebody's sipping their coffee, but it's like, it's a different, you know, it's like you dim the volume. But without God and without you, it's a place that is screaming and mostly screaming negative things. So I think I'll end now because we still have questions later. So thank you for letting me share.
Please join me in warmly thanking Ziva for sharing her strength and hope. And now I will ask the basket volunteers to begin passing the baskets to collect your questions for the question and answer portion of this workshop. Please address your questions to the panel and keep them focused on the topic of recovery from relapse. And we'll keep the basket we'll put down, and then we'll keep passing it till after our second speaker. Now, please join me in welcoming our second speaker, Karen.
Good morning, beautiful people. My name is Karen. I'm a compulsive overeater. I'm going to do a little adjusting. Sorry about the squeaking. Oh, that came from me. I cannot even tell you how incredibly thrilled I am to be here and to be looking out at your lovely and wonderful faces. Oh, my gosh. I remember thinking a couple of days ago, last week, about how excited I was to be coming here, because coming to the birthday party for me is like slipping into a warm bath. I just get enveloped with, I'm getting goosebumps. I give myself goosebumps sometimes. I get just enveloped with love and support and care and concern, and mostly you guys are my people. You are my people, and I am your people. I am healthy now. I'm not contagious at all, but I had the flu for 2 weeks. I was at home and in bed, so the cough came back a little bit today, so I apologize for that. I want to say that I have to laugh at myself. You know, we are not a glum lot, it says, I think, in the big book or the 12 and 12 or wherever it says it. I couldn't figure out what to wear. And I brought some nicer clothes. I remember somebody saying, you know, when you're going to speak in a meeting, you know, dress up a little bit and look nice. So I brought some other clothes, but a lot of my clothes are too big for me. And I keep wearing this. I don't shop. So I have these pants that are too big. And I thought, you know, my jeans actually fit me. And they actually show that I have a body. Excuse me, microphone. Oh, my God. Okay, for those of you who are listening on the tape, I just, you know, showed part of my body. Nothing R-rated or X-rated. This morning I thought, you know what, I'm going to wear the jeans. I mean, they're not dress-up, but they fit. And the blouse is a little bit baggy, but the other blouses are way too big. And so, you know, I like wearing clothes that fit. I also brought some pictures that show what I looked like all the way back, probably till from when I was about, less than one. Anyway, I'm not going to explain the pictures. They're pretty self-explanatory. So here are some pictures. One thing that I find is kind of funny, in the second picture of me as a little girl making a cute little face, I looked at that picture for years and years and years and years until I recognized that I have a Twinkie in my hand. I had no idea. I've been in program just by way of dates and times and such. I came into program in January of 1986. I started abstaining, well, a couple times I had a few false starts, and I started abstaining on April 19th of 1986. And abstained for, I guess, about 12 and a half years. until I tumbled mightily into relapse in 1998, and I relapsed for 10 years. I will tell you, though, in my relapse, I never stopped coming to meetings. I'd sit in meetings and cry and cry and cry, and those of you who are here who know me, you remember those days. And I just could not stop eating. I don't know. I wrote down, I don't usually write notes, I just wrote a couple. I don't know how I got out of relapse. I know a little bit about how I got into relapse. I've always blamed it on the fact that at the beginning, early 1998, my youngest brother was murdered by his wife and the guy she was having an affair with, and it was all kinds of stuff, and it was 4 years before they were arrested and 7.5 years before the trial and the conviction and the sentencing and all of that. So that was a lot of pain and a lot of difficulty. Also, in that time, my mother died. She lasted about 3 years after Joey, and we lost her as well. And it was not, I mean, she was sick for a long time. And I just couldn't deal with it. I just couldn't take it. And I'll tell you what, my pride and ego, I have this big pride and this big ego. And my pride and ego really wants to be able to say, I came in 1986, I got abstinent, and I never lost it. Last night at the long-timers roundtable, I've known these people since I walked into the program, and some of them are dear friends of mine, and I think that I should be up there too, damn it. That's not my path, and that's just the way it is. So I sometimes think that things probably got a little bit slippery even before Joey, and I think losing Joey just tipped me over the edge because my whole life had changed. I had migrated. I became an Australian permanent resident, and I was living in Sydney, Australia. At the time when I moved, I had 8 years of abstinence, and I was a long-timer. And there weren't a lot of people there who had recovery longer than I did, and so it became difficult for me to find somebody who'd walked the path before me. And there were some other reasons that I just sort of, I think I didn't work the program in the same way, and also leaving my OA home was harder for me than I realized it was going to be. I have since left my OA home again. I grew up in OA in Los Angeles in a group 8 years ago, 1986. So in October of 1986, I moved to Eagle Rock, which is in the San Gabriel Valley, the foothill inner group. And so I'm away from my people. I'm away from the people that I grew up with in OA. People in foothill are also, I mean, we all share the same disease. And one of the things that I think is so great about OA is I can come to it. I can talk to you. You know me. You understand me. You speak my language. It's like I can tell you the punchline to the joke without telling you the joke, and you get it anyway because you are in my shoes and I am in yours. You know, we may look different, we may have different specific experiences, but at the core level, we're so much alike, and I think that's one of the reasons this fellowship works so well. So I remember a day after we lost Joey, that I heard about Joey, somebody delivered food over, and I remember thinking, I wasn't at all hungry, but I thought, you know, I got to eat because I've got to do my 3 meals a day. And I made a turkey sandwich, and it tasted like cardboard. I remember thinking, this just does not have any taste. But I tried to keep doing this 3 meals a day, and then I just couldn't do it anymore. This is what relapse looked like for me. No limits on what I ate, when I ate, how I ate. I was going to Burger King and getting 2 Whoppers with pickles and tomatoes only, onion rings, and a chocolate shake. After a little while, I gave up the chocolate shake and went to the diet soda just because I liked the soda better. I would go to my therapist, and there was a Burger King near her, so I would go, I would eat, and then I don't remember if I would see her first and then eat or go do after. I don't remember the details. But the funny thing is, and I ate everything, anything, all time of day or night. I didn't know my top weight before I came into program because when I stepped on a scale and it said 199 pounds, I didn't step on it again because I did not want to see 200. In my relapse, the highest weight I remember seeing was 215. So I never focused that much on weight. And wouldn't you know, all these years later, now I'm focusing on weight. When I first came here, I didn't so much. For me, it was more, you know, I knew if I focused on the spiritual and the emotional aspect of the recovery, the physical would take care of itself, and that's exactly what happened. So now things are a little bit different. I'm not, you know, 26, 27 anymore, and my body doesn't work the same way as it used to, which I guess is true for all of us. But I always told myself that as long as I don't get candy bars at the checkout aisle at the grocery store, and as long as I don't go to a donut store and get a bunch of donuts and take them home, then I'm not that bad. It didn't matter that I would go to the gas station and, as my car's filling up, go in and get a packet of ding-dongs or whatever. That wasn't so bad. It's going to the donut store or walking up and down the candy aisle at 7-Eleven, or even more so, you know, at the grocery store. You know, they've got that, you know, that aisle that's always there of all the candy bars. So I figured I wasn't that bad. I knew I was bad, but I didn't think I was that bad. Then on a Thursday night in 2008, it was February 21st. That year, we didn't have the birthday party in January. We had it in February 2008. And that Thursday night, on my way home from work, I passed by a donut store. I go into the donut store. I don't remember how many donuts I bought. I don't know if it was probably not a complete dozen, but I bought a bunch of donuts. And, you know, they've got samples on the, well, some of you may know, some of you may not, but they had samples up there. So I ate a couple of samples while I was getting all my donuts. And I was less than a mile from my house. I probably ate two of them in the car on the way home and then sat on the sofa, turned on the TV, and ate a bunch more. to the point where my mouth felt like it was covered with wax, because all that oil and all that grease. And so at that point, I kind of knew I was screwed. But it took, you know, it takes what it takes. I went to the birthday party the next day and saw a friend of mine at the play who I've known for a long time, not super well, but just love. And we talked a little bit that night, and the next morning talked a little bit more, and I asked her to sponsor me. And she does, and for all these years now, she does. I got abstinent that next day, February 22nd. So if I don't, you know, do anything ridiculous and stupid between now and February 22nd, I will take a candle for 6 years. And again, my pride and ego wants to tell you that I'm, you know, on April 19th of this year, I'll be 20 whatever years out. Now, you know what? I lied. That's not true. I don't want to tell you that I've been abstaining since I walked in. I don't want to tell you that. Wow, that's a bolt that I hadn't thought of before. It's only when there are long-timer panels and things like that I think, hey, I want to be part of that. Because I want the attention and the adulation. My default position is a near total and complete lack of self-esteem. I learned growing up, I didn't know until I was 13, but I had a brother who died before I was born. And I came to believe somehow, I picked up, that maybe Barry should have lived and I should have died. And so I didn't believe that this rectangle of space that I took up, I was really entitled to. So I had to do things to get you to like me, to make it be okay that I was on the planet. I would, you know, steal money and buy you things. I would let you cheat on my test in class. I remember there was a boy I had a crush on, and he did something wrong, and he had to write an essay on why he wouldn't do this anymore, and I wrote it for him because I thought that would make him like me. I don't even remember what it was he did. So I would do anything to get you to like me, because if I had something positive reflecting back, then I could stay alive. Because I was just so lost and so adrift and so unloved and so unlovable and so awful. And the way one of the ways I handled that is I bragged and boasted. I told you all these amazing things about me, true or not, because then you would be impressed and you would like me. Sometimes I still find myself wanting to do that. I try not to so much. Anyway, as I said, I can't tell you exactly how I got out of relapse, but I can tell you some things that I think make a huge difference. I did not stop going to meetings. As I mentioned, I did not stop coming to meetings. Now, I think I might have gone as long as 2 weeks without a meeting, but not much more than that. And, you know, it was really easy for me to stay in the OA world because I didn't have any other world. When I came to OA, well, as I say, I came in 1986. There is nobody in my life today that I knew prior to 1986 except for people I'm related to by blood. I didn't know how to make a friend. I didn't know how to be a friend. I didn't know how to keep a friend. So when people talk about, you know, their high school reunion or their college reunion or friends they've had since kindergarten, I'm a little envious of that because I don't have that. So all of my social life were OA people. So it was kind of hard to disappear anyway, for which I'm very grateful. There's this little pamphlety thing. It's called the Pocket Reference for OA Members. And it says it really well. I love this. I carry it around in my purse. This is actually my second one. My first one is so tattered that it's all taped and beat up, and I have it in a box for posterity, I guess. My father used to say, well, save it for Sam, posterity. Save it for Sam. If you remove your body from the truth, when you are ready, the truth is nowhere to be found. But if you continue to bring your body to the truth, then when you are ready, the truth is waiting there for you. And that truth, our promise of recovery, is in every OA meeting when we join hands, pray together, and joyously, lovingly encourage each other to keep coming back. I am goosebump city. I love this. I'm pretty sure Roseanne wrote this. God love her. So I continue to bring my body to the truth. Now, I had the flu, and I was doing some traveling, and I haven't been to a meeting probably in about a month. And isn't this interesting that in this last little while I've been writing to my sponsor about how lost and how out of touch and how floaty and limbo I am. Gee, Karen, come to meetings. That may help. So here's what I do on a daily basis to stay in recovery today. And let me tell you, it's not perfect. I still have, I think I'm about 174 pounds right now from 215. My mother always used to say, Karen, don't tell anybody how much you weigh because you weigh more than you look. And I've always weighed more than I look. I would never tell you my weight. I would never tell you what I ate. And I'd never tell you how much money I made. Never tell you those things. These days, I still don't talk so much about money because I make a tiny little bit. But now I will tell you how much I weigh, and I tell my sponsor everything I eat every night. Because here's what I do. I wake up in the morning. How much time do I have? 5. Okay. Thank you. Perfect. So every morning I get up, I get on my knees, and I pray. Now, I am Jewish, and I wasn't taught to pray on my knees. But when I, early in program, I heard somebody say that when I get on my knees, I humble myself before my higher power. And I certainly could relate to that because humility and I didn't know each other. I was one of those people who confused humility with humiliation. I thought, oh, if I you know, do something really stupid and embarrassing, then I'll get humility. Anyway, so I'm on my knees and I pray and I say the third step prayer and the seventh step prayer. And this year, just this past, 2014, I've decided to try to learn the 11th step prayer. Lord, make me a channel of thy peace. Because I need to learn about self-forgetting. And I want to learn to love rather than to be loved, to comfort rather than comfort, to understand than to be understood. Because it is by self-forgetting that one finds. And I find myself so selfish and so self-centered that I can't stand it anymore. I don't want to be thinking about other people. About myself all the time. I want to be thinking about other people. I also read daily meditation books. And they rotate each year. Although I always end up going back to the Our For Today book. I love it. I just love it. I love it. This year I'm reading an AA book also. And then another one in the evening that's not an OA-approved literature. I was reading Voices of Recovery, which is really great. It helps me learn about relapse and how this program works so well. Also, before I was going to bed at night, I was reading one of the stories out of the book, the little thin green one called A New Beginning. And those are, they were culled from Lifeline, and they're stories about recovery from relapse. So I highly recommend that. It was a great way to end my night. So I pray in the morning. I have my breakfast. I eat 3 meals a day. I don't eat anything in between, except if I'm in a situation where there's going to be a lot of time between breakfast and lunch or lunch and dinner, and I want to have an apple or some sort of snack, I text my sponsor first and say, I'm going to have a snack because whatever. Or sometimes I don't even say why, because we kind of she knows why I'm going to have a snack because there's a reason for it. I just don't do it because, hey, I want to eat. Usually that is anyway. So I don't have that snack unless I text her first. And then breakfast, lunch, dinner. Then at night, I pray again. I'm on my knees, and I say a prayer that I learned a long time ago from a friend, and I read, the meditations again. But the other thing that I've been doing since February 22nd, 2008, and I haven't missed a night. And it's funny. When I first came into OA, they said, go to 30 meetings in 30 days. And I so badly wanted to do that because I wanted to be able to say I did it perfectly. Nowadays, I think they say go to 90 in 90 days, and I'm really glad I came in when I did. As it is, I only made 28 in 30 days. It wasn't perfectly. But here is something. There's two things that I've done consistently for the last 6 years. Breathe. And send an email to my sponsor before I go to bed. And here's what I write. I tell her, sometimes I'll tell her a little bit about the day, what's happened, if something comes up. Sometimes it's just a storytelling. And today I did this, and today I did that. It was a good day, it was a bad day. I worked really hard, I didn't work really hard. But there are two things that I always do. I always write down my food. That's what I had for breakfast, what I had for lunch, what I had for dinner. And I write down five things I'm grateful for. And number one is always abstinence. And I even have a bracelet that says abstinence first. Because I never considered abstinence. I always heard people say abstinence is the most important thing in my life without exception. It never was for me. And even now, I don't always consciously think about it, which is why I have the reminder and I have my email reminder. I would tell you, even when I had surgery and I couldn't move my arm, I dictated my email to my sponsor and she typed it for me. And when I was sick with the flu these past 2 weeks and couldn't sit at the computer, I did it on my phone. And I am not a good phone typist. But there are two reasons why I do it every single night. Not in this order, but one of them is so I can say I've done it every single night and haven't missed in, 6 years. But even more so because one of the things that my sponsor has taught me that I was never very good at is total and complete and unconditional honesty. No matter what, whether I'm embarrassed or ashamed or can't even believe that I did it, I'll even say I'm embarrassed, but here it is. And I'm not judged, I'm not criticized, and her lovingly delightful, incredible warmth allows me to continue to be honest. Because if I'm not honest, that it's like a sliver. And a sliver, if you don't pull it out, it's not such a big deal at the beginning, but then it starts to get infected and it gets pussy and your finger swells and then your hand swells and then you have to have your arm amputated. Okay, not that I'm dramatic or melodramatic or anything, but so I am so grateful for this gift of honesty. So the parting message that I will leave you with, if I may, is twofold. One is, no matter what, just be here. Just show up, no matter what. Whether you want to or not, whether you're happy or not, whether you're overweight, underweight, abstaining, not abstaining, binging, not abstaining, show up. Because if you bring your body to the truth is here waiting for you. Secondly, recovery is in these rooms. And one of the lovely gifts that I've received from being here is hope. Because I've seen it. I have seen evidence of people recovering from miserable, awful, horrible things. So I don't just have to have faith. I also have evidence. So if you have trouble with faith and hope, use the evidence. Look at the people around you. Listen to the people around you. And I'm so glad that you're here because this means I get to recover for another day. I'm so grateful, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Sharon. We will now have our volunteers collect the final questions for the Ask It Basket so that we can begin the question time. And before, I did get a little announcement that I need to make for those of you who are staying at the hotel. You need to be checked out before noon, and this cannot be extended. And that was a message from the registration and the committee members. Okay, so if you haven't checked out, or you don't, we do finish here by 11, so you still have time after this workshop to do that. So if the Ask a Basket is going around, I will begin with the questions that I have already, which are probably going to be more directed to Ziva, but both of you can answer. Usually they're kind of generic questions. Okay. I have regained 35 to 40 pounds that I lost. I'm in pain physically and spiritually. Help. Okay, can you move that? That one moves down.
Oh, does it?
Yeah.
Oh, it does.
Oh, yeah.
No, it doesn't. It's taped.
It's taped, okay.
So I'm sorry, whoever wrote it, I'm sorry that you are in pain. And the only thing I can tell everyone is that what worked for me is inviting that power that I don't know what it is into the picture. I had the biggest resistance to do it. But what I would suggest to that person, and I will do it too, by the way, because there is something very energizing in this weekend and something very scary about getting out there into my life and the food and everything. So what I would suggest to that person is at the end of the conference today, if you came in a car, then in the car or wherever, to sit for a few minutes and tell God, I am in pain, I gained all this weight, and I need you to be close to me for the rest of today. And maybe call somebody and commit your food. Because there is nothing that I can say that will make you abstinent. So that's what I would do today, and that's what I've been doing in those last 6 years. So I hope it helps.
One of the things that I was thinking about, and one of the things that I've been trying to do myself a little bit, is I'm a classic A1 isolator. So I now have a date to meet a friend at a meeting and go out to lunch afterwards. So if any of you, I live in Eagle Rock, I can travel around a little bit. If you'd like to make a date to go to a meeting with me, I will go to a meeting with you, and we will show up around people who are, you know, we'll go and hear the message together. And so you don't have to do it by yourself. So, and I'm happy to give out my phone number, but not on the tape. So, because I think being around the fellowship, for me, I reach out to God as often as I can. I reach out to God a lot. And sometimes I can hear, and sometimes my disease filter blocks that message. It blocks the outgoing and it blocks the incoming. But when I go to a meeting and I'm around other people, whether I listen at the meeting or not, because sometimes I zone out a little bit, but at least I'm there and I'm around other people who are like me. So that's my open invitation to you and anybody else who wants to do that.
Do you think it is possible to do this program without a sponsor? I keep losing them, and I keep fighting against their their restrictions, and I can't seem to stop. Anyone have to deal with this?
Can you do this program without a sponsor? I think not. Because if I'm not working with a sponsor, then I'm trying to do it myself. And myself got me to, 200 whatever pounds. So I think not. It's not always, I was listening to people talk last night, and I am one of those people sometimes when a sponsor gives me direction and I don't do it, I say yes, but I couldn't or whatever. And sometimes I don't have the willingness. So the thing is to find somebody who has what you want and who is willing to help you, not just where they are, but where you are. And sometimes it just takes what it takes to get willing. But I think you've got to have a sponsor. I cannot imagine working this program without a sponsor. I can't.
Let's go to the next.
What is the difference between a slip and a break? Now I got it. A break in abstinence. What is relapse for you?
So again, I guess you can ask many people. You'll get different answers. For me, a slip. Okay, I cannot eat dessert. As I said, if I eat anything that's called dessert, even if it's sugar free, I broke my abstinence. I have to start fresh. However, a slip could be having a bigger meal, making a choice that is imperfect. And a relapse is not just breaking my abstinence, but being, for me, a relapse was a period of almost 10 years of binging, and of drowning again in self-hate. In the 10 years, we're broken into, I would be in that binging state for a few months and then try and get it again and get 6 days of abstinence and then binge again. So a relapse is just a continuous period of time for me of being disconnected from God and binging and drowning in self-hate and self-pity.
You know, I think that's a really tough one, and I think it's different for everybody. I think for me, the length of time that I'm out of not feeling connected with people and with God is a good definer, if you will. But I decided, well, I didn't decide. My sponsor helped me to learn that not to get so hung up on slip versus break versus not, and instead, if I eat something that I wish I hadn't eaten, I've learned from her to say, oh, well, and I move on. I learned a long time ago, I heard somebody say that, you know, if you're taking a road trip from California to New York and you take a wrong turn in Chicago, you don't go all the way back to California and start over again. You just keep going. That's not original. I can't take credit for that. So for me, you know, there's enough self-flagellation. I beat myself up enough that to add to it, I sponsor a woman who had this exact same question and the exact same difficulty. And you know what? We don't even count with her. She doesn't even count. It's just moving forward. She has a bad day with food. It's like, okay, oh well, tomorrow's a new day, and we just keep going forward. I think that's... It's gentle, it's loving, it's better. And also, the other way doesn't work. Oh, am I abstinent? Am I not abstinent? When I first got abstinent and I had a little slippy thing, I ate something and I wasn't sure, God, am I abstinent? Am I not? Because I have a low tolerance for ambiguity, I went out and had a full-blown binge so I could say, okay, now I know I'm not abstinent. So if you're not sure, just keep going forward. My opinion, not everybody agrees, and that's okay.
I think this is Ziva. Would you please repeat the bookend story?
The bookend technique for me is when I know that I'm going to be in a situation that is triggering for me on an emotional level or on a physical level. I bookend it, meaning I call somebody that is available before the event, and the idea is not a phone message. It's a live person. And then I tell them what is my intention during this emotional time. And then I ask God to join me. And then I call that person after. So if I'm going to be in a family situation with somebody that triggers me, I will tell that person, you know, I'm not going to engage in a conversation with that person. I'm just going to ask how they're doing and wish them a happy new year. Let's say it's a holiday time, okay? If it's a work situation where I'm exposed to a lot of food, which is triggering for me physically, I would say, this is my plan. And then I will call the person at the end and say how it went so that there is some closure and accountability.
How do you know when you need a new sponsor?
The simple answer is, well, it's not working anymore. Well, there are a couple of ways that I've had a number of sponsors over the years. I've had sponsors who were not available to me. I've had sponsors that I didn't listen to. And after a little while, if I'm not listening to them, there's something wrong. If I find that I am afraid to call, I'm not willing to listen, I feel judged, or I'm, you know, getting yelled at, or I, you know, otherwise, it, you know, if I don't feel like I'm being cared about, if I don't feel affection, and if I don't feel closeness while I'm learning, then for me it's not working because I'm not going to listen. So for me, it's got to be somebody that I'm willing to talk to, willing to listen to, willing to stay in touch with. If I'm not willing, it's not really the sponsor's fault necessarily. But for me, that's what it was. And I actually did have one sponsor who I was working with while I was in relapse. And after a little while, she just couldn't handle it anymore, and she let me go. She yelled and screamed at me over the phone, actually, and let me go, which wasn't fun. But I think it's, you know, if you're not willing to call and you're not willing to listen, maybe you've got the wrong person. Or maybe it's looking in the mirror and it's just a problem, you know, you're just not willing to listen to anybody. I don't know. Is that
How does your higher power communicate his will to you?
I feel that my higher power talks to me through you. You know, it's a very tangible thing. It's through the messengers on earth that I get the messages. I don't get it in any other way. But the one thing that I know for sure is that when I hear in my head a very loud, angry, resentful voice, it's not my higher power. When I hear a soft-spoken, gentle, kind, loving message, I can attribute it to my higher power. I don't know where this higher power is. Most of the time I feel that it's inside of me. It's not somewhere outside. So inside of me are all those, you know, messages. Some of them are kind and loving and program-based, and some of them are angry and resentful, and that's usually not my higher power.
I'm sorry, I had a quick thought I wanted to add about the previous question about sponsorship. I came to realize early last year, or late the year before, that I needed to go through the steps. It had been a long time since I'd worked the steps. And my sponsor said she wasn't really available, didn't have the time to put in with me to work the steps, and suggested that I find somebody else to work the steps with, and so I did. So I have a sponsor that I work the steps with, and the sponsor who fills my heart in a different way. So I just wanted to add that to the sponsor. So maybe it's not you need a different sponsor. Maybe you need different sponsors for different things. You don't have to have just one.
Can one of you or both of you define what you mean by imperfect abstinence?
Right, imperfect abstinence. Two bread rolls with dinner instead of just one. Imperfect abstinence for me means that, you know, it's funny because there's the food plan and abstinence. And I came into OA when there was no such thing as a food plan. We didn't call it food plan. That wasn't a tool. It was a plan of eating. They didn't have that. Imperfect abstinence for me, I think, means that, well, let me define perfect abstinence. Perfect abstinence for me is 3 meals a day, nothing in between, perfectly moderate portions, I don't eat sugar at all, don't eat recreational sugar. But there are days, like the other night I don't eat, true confessions, I don't eat pizza. I've eaten pizza once since 1989. But about a week ago I ordered this appetizer, they actually called it pizza nachos. In my email, I didn't call it pizza nachos. I called it something else because I didn't want to use the word pizza because I didn't want my sponsor to see that I had pizza nachos. And she's in this room, so now she knows. honesty, sometimes it takes me a week. I did say it was pieces of pizza dough and what it was. So for me, that, you know, that's in my meal. That was part of my dinner. Is that perfect? Well, no, because it's not perfect food, but it's breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You know, I had breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Sometimes I have that snack. There probably has been a time when I've eaten the snack and thought, oh, shoot, I forgot to text her and tell her I'm having that apple, and I do it after. So it's those little imperfections. That doesn't, you know, so they're okay. It's okay, you know. So what, as you say, you know, oh, well. So for me, that's kind of imperfect because, boy, oh, boy, I will never be perfect at anything. I used to think the only thing I would be perfect at was breathing, but even that I'm not because I got pneumonia sometimes and I get the flu and so on.
So I think because we are in a meeting about recovery from relapse, I do want to answer this question too. I want to say what imperfect abstinence is today and why even that is recovery. So imperfect day for me, which happened as soon as a week ago, is having a very triggering day at work. I won't go into any of the reasons. And eating at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, which is no lunch, no dinner, 15 crackers. That's the bad news. The good news is that I called my sponsor and I let her know that I did it. By saying it, I was able to release it. asking God to be close to me for the rest of the day and having a beautiful, perfect abstinent dinner. That's recovery. And that's recovery from relapse. Because years ago, those 14 crackers would lead to cheese, because you can't eat crackers without cheese. And that would lead to something sweet, like maybe on the way home I would call somebody and say, do you feel like ice cream? And the person would say, not really, but I would buy it anyway. And that would lead to a binge and then a relapse, which is months and months of binging and hating myself. So imperfect abstinence are those 14 crackers. I didn't do it in the last week and a half, and I'm hoping not to do it in the next week and a half, but this might happen. I mean, I am a compulsive overeater, I have a disease, and those things might happen. But the recovery is what we do at the moment and what we do next.
Five more minutes. Okay. The next question I have is, I want my sponsor to be my cheerleader. Am I wrong?
I mean, it's not necessarily wrong. If that's what you need to find the cheerleader. I want my sponsor to be somebody that I can trust, that I can feel safe, you know, sharing the crackers, the imperfection, as well as the perfection. I want my sponsor to have something that I want, and I told you before that what I want today is somebody who lives, has a healthy relationship with people in their lives, with their body, and with food. So if you need a cheerleader and you find one, why not?
You know, I wouldn't have thought of that word, but yes, I think my sponsor is my cheerleader. Because the feedback that I get is always positive, but it's also honest. Like, she's got this thing that she learned some time ago and says with me from time to time, where she'll ask a question. She calls it poking the Pillsbury Doughboy, just to see what happens. I'll give you an example. My partner is not in program. She drinks wine, and I don't really like wine that much, but I like to sip her wine just to taste it. What is it like? Just to see the differences. And then one day I get the response from my email saying, you know, I'm just gonna, you know, just poking the doughboy here. Do you really need to sip your partner's wine? And I started to realize, I thought, you know, there's a lot of calories in wine, and it's alcohol, and I've got ulcerative colitis. I shouldn't have alcohol, and, you know, maybe I don't need to do that. So she doesn't tell me what to do, but she raises questions. That's the only one that I can think of at the moment, but there are others. And sometimes I'll read the question, and I'll feel a little sting. And I feel a little sting because she's hit something. And God love her for that, because, you know, if she's not going to point out things that I need to look at and perhaps improve, then what am I doing? Then why am I having her as a sponsor? Because my goal is to be able to work the steps, learn the program, stay in recovery, and be okay with myself. And I feel very, very loved, very loved. And I don't get that in a lot of places. So I say, if you want a cheerleader sponsor, go for it.
This is, there's a question on this paper for Ziva and then for you, Karen. Okay. There's the, for Ziva, can you talk about how you started abstaining again, how you got the thoughts of redoing it over and the thought of giving up on day 12 or early in your new, once again, abstinence? How did you keep moving?
Okay, and I guess we only have like a minute and a half, so we can talk after the meeting, whoever that person is. But what I can say is those 6 years were built of 1 minute at a time. When I became abstinent this time, I did not believe that I can even have 30 days. So it was really one tiny step at a time. Sometimes it was 1 hour at a time. And I remember when I celebrated 1 year, I couldn't believe it. And I couldn't believe it, and I was sure that it's the, you know, that in a day or two it will be over, and I'll have to start again. So it's really 1 second at a time, and just, you know, doing what you know works for you, and inviting God into the picture, whatever that God means to you.
It's almost the same. You know, how do you not get discouraged that the years won't add up? You know, that you're start. It's a leap of faith, but, you know, the frustration. How did you get over, you know, losing, you know, letting go of those 10 years of not abstaining?
It sounds like there's a couple of questions in there. I sometimes am quite saddened that I lost 10 years of abstinence because my pride and ego would love to be able to tell you that I'm abstaining 28 years. On the other hand, if I hadn't had 10 years of relapse, I wouldn't be standing here being of service to you. And I wouldn't be compassionate to people who have challenges with food. I would not have the compassion that I have now. So, you know, that promise that says we will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it is really true. Because I mean, again, when it's, you know, I want to be hip, slick, and cool and show you the numbers and all that, when that pops up, then yes, I absolutely regret it, but not really, because I mean, that's when the character defect takes over. But I can be of a unique service to people in certain ways. I have a death of a brother. I've lost both of my a murder of a brother, lost both of my parents. 10 years in relapse, never left program. Abstaining now, so that makes me be a channel in a lot of different ways to a lot of different people because I can relate to you in ways. You know, the person who has had, you know, perfect abstinence for 30 years, I can't really relate to that actually because I didn't have that. I want to hear the struggles and how you get past it. So for me, I've had struggles and I'm getting past them. Also, I don't think, honestly, most of the time, it's like, oh yeah, I'm almost 6 years. I don't think about that so much. So when I just realized that it really is one day at a time, although sometimes I'll think about next week, but I try not to think about building up years. Because when I think of building up years, you know, I'm never going to catch my sponsor's number of years of abstinence. I'm never going to catch, you know, the folks who spoke last night. I'm never going to catch them. I'm never going to be equal to them. I might, God willing, I'll have 30 years someday if I live that long, but those people will then have 60. So I'm not going to catch them. So I should stop trying. And just realize that I am where I am, and where I am is fine. And it's not about the numbers. It's not about being able to impress people with how many years of abstinence you have. I used to think that was true. I used to think I'd have to tell you how wonderful I was and how many years of absence and how much weight and all that stuff. I don't have to do that anymore. I just have to, you know, be a friend. That's really all I got to do.
Thank you very much. This part of the workshop is devoted to the tool of writing. Immediately following our timed 10-minute writing time, and this you'll hear a timer go off in 10 minutes. There'll be time for you to take a little bit of a stretch break, and then we'll, after the break, there will be time for you to do 3-minute shares to come up to the podium. On the podium, there will be a piece of paper, and I ask you to sign it as a notice that you realize you're being recorded. So this is a release form. So before we begin our reading, I'd like to read from you from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, The Doctor's Opinion. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. That the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. If any feel that a psychiatrist directing a hospital for alcoholics we appear somewhat sentimental. Let them stand with us for us a while on the firing line. See the tragedies, the despairing wives, the little children. Let the solving of these problems become a part of their daily work and even of their sleeping moments. And the most cynical will not wonder that we have accepted and encouraged this movement. We feel, after many years of experience, that we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men than the altruistic movement now growing up among them. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are relentless, irritable, and discontented. They are restless, irritable and discontented. Unless they can experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, the phenomenon of craving develops. They pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. On the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. So now we'll begin our time of writing.